It is time for the single coolest sports show in the country, The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics.
You've got Matt Bonner, who my notes tell me is a sandwich blogger named Red Mamba. I mean, how can you not like a guy like that?
And the Red Rocket knocks down the triple.
Red Rocket, telling you, Red Mamba might not miss a shot.
Just like in politics, in the instructional video business, you need credibility.
You want credibility? I'll give you credibility. Hey, Tim, what's my nickname?
The Red Rocket.
No.
The Sandwich Hunter?
No. Fry Gun.
The Medium Fundamental?
Welcome to The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. I'm Chris Ryan here in the great state of New Hampshire, following the Celtics side of things, and Matt following Western Conference side of things with the San Antonio Spurs. This segment of the show is powered by Revision Energy. For the past 9 years, their team of local solar professionals have been putting sunshine to work for thousands of Granite State families and businesses looking to save money and help save the planet for our kids. Visit revisionenergy.com to schedule a free consultation. That's revisionenergy.com. What can sunshine do for you? And that is, you know, really the mood around the Celtics right now going into Game 5 with all the fans. Sunshine and rainbows and unicorns, man. Brad Stevens. And lollipops. Brad Stevens getting raked over the coals because he can't find the right unit to stop the Washington Wizards for not taking a timeout during a 22-0 run.
And they'll win the next two, and all that will disappear.
Brad Stevens will go back to being the greatest coach ever. Everybody will be like, oh, look what he did there, putting Jonas Jerebko on the starting lineup. That changed everything for the Celtics. So, we'll do the sports talk thing. I've been thinking about this. We've actually put about, 3 minutes of prep time into the show today. And so we're going to do like that sports talk thing at the beginning where we're going to say who is in better shape right now, the Spurs or the Celtics, regardless of the fact that it doesn't mean anything at all and one has nothing to do with the other. But since you're kind of on the Spurs side of things and I'm on the Celtics side of things, we're going to marry those two things right now. So would you rather be, here we go. Little background. Now, here we go. Would you rather be the Celtics going into Game 5 against the Wizards, or would you rather be the Spurs going into Game 5 against the Rockets, both series tied at 2 games apiece? Go.
Well, me personally, I'd rather be the Celtics I wouldn't want to be the Spurs. I would want to be the Celtics because their opponent, the Houston Rockets, is a much better team than the Washington Wizards.
Oh!
If you take that out of it, all things considered, I'd rather be the Spurs because at least they won a game on the road and aren't going back home having lost two straight. I think like psychology of a series, if you lose one game, I think it's a benefit the following game. Like if you just lost one game, it makes you refocus, hungrier, more intense, you don't take possessions off or for granted. But if you lose two, I think then the whole momentum argument is called to order, where now the team that beat you twice is feeling confident and has momentum, and the team that has lost twice is maybe not as confident and does not have momentum. I don't know if you're following, smelling what I'm cooking there.
But, smells like fish.
If you win one, all right, let's say, take the Spurs for example, okay? Game 4, Spurs lose, Rockets win. Going into Game 5, the Rockets are going to kind of be feeling themselves a little bit. And it's just human nature. They're going to relax. They're going to be confident, relaxed, whereas the Spurs are like, oh, we lost. It's just one game. We need to fix this, this, and this, and we can get back on the winning track. You take the Celtics situation, they've lost two in a row. Their chance to kind of steal one was last game because Washington came out in Game 3 and won. They're going to relax going into Game 4. And if you don't and you lose two in a row, then that whole psychology side goes out the window. And now it goes from, relaxed to confident. Like, we got these guys. We beat them twice in a row. Let's do this. So that's why I'd rather be the Spurs.
I'd rather be, It's difficult to say. I agree with you on the momentum side of things. The thing that's different, obviously, is that you know the Spurs are not healthy, and they're not going to be healthy for the rest of the postseason, obviously, with Tony Parker being out. And the Celtics, you know, at least have their full squad, and they're not, you know, trying to do anything, you know, too different. And granted, you know, the Spurs have already won a game without, you know, Tony Parker in the lineup, but still, it seems like the Spurs are trying to find themselves. Pop pointed particularly to transition defense, and I think that both of these series hinge on defense at this point. And I think that Washington still has to prove to me that they can defend the Celtics in Boston, and that they're just not going to get the energy from the home crowd and commit defensively at home, and that they're going to be able to carry that defensive effort on the road. They've shown they can score this series. The Celtics haven't shown they can really stop the Wizards at all so far. You know, even though Wall and Beal aren't putting up numbers that jump out at you, 29 points for Beal the last game, 27 for Wall. He had 12 assists as well. And Wall went off for 40 in game two, the overtime game. But it's everybody collectively who's scoring against the Celtics. Celtics have been slow, particularly on the help defense. And for the Spurs, difficult when they lose. They've gotten blown out in the series. They've been, you know, not been able to get back in transition. So that's where it all hinges for me. The question is, can the Spurs, you know, defend in transition and keep the Rockets in the half court and shooting threes? And the question, since the Celtics have the home court and can just win games five and seven and move on, can Washington defend in Boston?
That's a valid point. I mean, this whole discussion and argument brings up the point, do you do away with the conferences when it comes to playoff seeding? Because it seems like this happens quite often with the San Antonio Spurs. They won 60-plus games, and in the second round of the playoffs, they're playing the team with the third-best record in the entire NBA. And that's just the perennial difference between East and West, it seems like, in the league. And you know, if you did away with those strict brackets where, you know, only East and West teams play each other until the finals, I don't know who the Spurs would be playing, but I'm guessing they'd have an easier time of it than going against Houston.
Yeah, I mean, that there is a precedent and tradition and so forth, and I think that there's, you know, something to that. You don't get the NHL right now. The NHL has completely screwed up their playoffs, where they have they've gone to a divisional round, divisional format, sort of. And so you have the two best teams, arguably, in hockey, in the Capitals and the Penguins, facing each other in the Eastern Conference semifinals because they play in the same division.
The second and the third best teams playing each other in the second round, same thing in the NBA, pretty much. I mean, if you're going to say hockey's playoffs are
the Rockets aren't there. The Rockets aren't the third best team in the Rockets aren't the third best team in the NBA. I mean, the Cavs are the third best team.
They have the third best record.
They have a better record than the Cavs?
Yes.
Right. You're right. I understand, but there's so you just want to seed everybody and do away completely with the conferences. I mean, there's more precedent for that, baseball.
No, last year we played Oklahoma City in the second round and won like 59 games or 58 games. The year before we played the Clippers in the first round. Each of us won 55 plus games. We played them in the first round. You know, it's just and then you look at, no offense to the East, but you look at the East and it's like, you know, come on. This just doesn't seem fair. And I know I'm sounding like a crybaby right now, but I can because I don't play anymore.
Right, you are.
This is my job to stir the pot, stir up controversy.
I'd say there's more precedent. You could do it in the NBA as opposed to baseball or football, where you had the American Football Conference, the National Football Conference, they merged together. American League, National League, you know, same thing. And it's not as blasphemous as you know, it would be in football, but I mean I don't think there'd be a huge outcry if it took place, and it's probably, you know, the fairest quote unquote thing to do. And as I was kind of referencing before, the NHL went a step in the wrong direction in my view, and they made it more based on divisional matchups, and then there's a greater chance of having what you have right now with the Capitals and the Penguins, the two best teams in hockey, facing each other this round. And then, you know, you have the Rangers, who are the wild card team, playing Ottawa and the other one, and then out you could have Nashville or Edmonton in the finals, and they're gonna that's gonna be a huge draw. So they really, I mean, the NHL really screwed up by going into more of a divisional based playoff formula. But I think, yeah, I mean, I'm fine. Yeah, I'm fine with that.
It's like globalization, you know. We need to, you know, create. They have NAFTA. We need like to break down the borders in these leagues. Free trade among conferences.
Yeah, and there's not like in Major League Baseball. There's obviously a difference in rules and so forth. I could hear the argument. I'm not against it because I think that if you want to have a true champion, this is and you want to have the two best teams. That's the way to go. Would you change the scheduling too? Would you have everybody play the same amount of times? And then how would that affect the the travel and all of the league's already obviously
every team charters their flight. Travel's not an issue.
Right, but you have to fly a longer distance.
Oh my gosh, you have to sit on a chartered first class jet for an extra 30 minutes.
Some people complain about that. Some people complain about that. You know that's true.
You know what? That's ridiculous. Guys shouldn't have to sit on a plane for an extra 30 minutes just to be fair. So we can have fair playoffs. You're right. Let's scrap this idea.
Do you think NBA players would be upset if you increase the travel so they had to go to Sacramento twice and all the Western teams twice? Do you think the Players Association would go for that?
No, but you wouldn't. You play every team, about three times. And you wouldn't play every West Coast team twice at their place. You'd get a mixture.
So you're thinking, but again, that's then you'd have to have nine. How many teams are there in the league? 30? 32?
Yeah.
So you'd have to play, then there'd still be inequity, but it would be more equitable, I guess, than it would the current format. So they have it. We've solved the problem here. It's Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. This segment of the show brought to you by Revision Energy. Coming up next, Xander Bogaerts, Red Sox shortstop, sits down with me, and also Daron Harmon, safety from the New England Patriots. It comes your way. We'll talk more Celtics and Wizards in the final segment of the show. You're listening to The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. Welcome back here on The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. We'll take a look at the Celtics and Wizards series and have our conversation with Xander Bogaerts in just a moment here on the program. This segment of the show is powered by Revision Energy. For the past 9 years, their team of local solar professionals have been putting sunshine to work for thousands of Granite State families and businesses looking to save money and help save the planet for our kids. Visit revisionenergy.com to schedule a free consultation. That's revisionenergy.com. What can sunshine do for you? Boston Celtics. He's a little sunshine after losing the last two games in blowout fashion to the Washington Wizards in Washington, games 3 and 4. Luckily, they won the first two games, so the series is tied at 2 games apiece heading back to Boston. And the Celtics are right where they need to be in the context of this series. They have 2 home games out of the next 3, and they need to win both of those games, and they move on to the Eastern Conference Finals for the first time since 2010. It's easier said than done, perhaps, particularly after the Wizards may have found themselves over the last couple of games, particularly on the defensive side of things. Here is Celtics head coach Brad Stevens.
I just don't want to sit up here and talk about what we're not doing. You have to credit them. I mean, they're playing really well. They're a good team, really talented, really athletic. Their length is bothering us. We have to do a better job of utilizing spacing to take some of their length out of the play. You know, if they have a 22-0 run or a 26-0 run, we're not going to win. You know, I think that's pretty obvious. And that's been the case each of the last 2 games, and we have to play better on Wednesday.
Stevens there talking about the 26-0 run in the third quarter that catapulted the Wizards to the 121-102 win against the Celtics in Game 4 of the Eastern Conference semifinals. John Wall was really good with 27 points, 12 assists, and 5 steals. His 12 assists were key, really, I thought, for the Wizards spreading the basketball, and Bradley Beal stepped up for the first time in this series to have a plus game, 29 points on 11 of 16 shooting. Here's Beal.
It was just being aggressive, not just picking my spots. My teammates do a great job of screening and getting me open, and the guys on the weak side do a tremendous job of, cutting and spotting up and knocking them down if that's the case. So just being smarter with the ball, being confident with my handle, and, just not turning it over.
Question, though, is can the Wizards defend the way that they did in games 3 and 4 in Boston. This is where the Celtics are putting up 120-plus points a night. That is the question. John Wall says they have to play better defensively.
We know we have the ability to win there. I think we just got to bring that same defense intensity that we had the two games we had here. Because when we played there, we didn't play great defense, and we still had a chance to win those games.
Celtics guard Isaiah Thomas says they weren't able to contain the Wizards during the third quarter. Also, Isaiah didn't score like he did in Boston. Of course, you know, you're not going to score 53 points every night. Wizards held him to 19 in game 4.
Once they got going, I mean, that's like us getting going in the garden. It's hard to stop. And we wasn't making shots. We felt like we got the shots we wanted, but they just wasn't falling, and they got in their run. They got a few and ones as well, and the momentum was definitely on their side.
All right, that is Celtic star Isaiah Thomas. We'll transition to the Red Sox now. And the Red Sox not off to a great start this year at 17-14. If the season ended today, which it does not, there's still a lot of baseball to be played. There's only 31 games in the season. Red Sox will be in the second wild card spot. The problem really has been the offense. Up until this weekend, they weren't scoring runs. Up and down the lineup, good batting averages, but not enough run production. The Red Sox had scored, you know, in bunches. They'd put a crooked number up for an inning or two a game, but that would be it, if at all, during the contest. Really, the leader offensively for the Red Sox this year has been unquestionably Andrew Benintendi, who's had a tremendous first month. I talked to him about the Red Sox offensive production before the team left for the road trip.
Talk about the kind of the first month for you, the first month for the Red Sox. How would you kind of sum up the production?
I feel like we haven't really hit our stride yet, but I feel like we're going out there and competing every night and giving, you know, ourselves a chance to win on the mound, and especially on the mound, and I think that offense will catch up eventually.
At times you think there's too much of a hyper focus on, you know, that first month because it's the only sample so far, and if this happens like in July or August, there's not necessarily, you know, that much focus. People say, well, it's part of the process, and the team's going to hit a slump like this or a stretch like this regardless of the season.
Yeah, I mean, it is a small sample size, and it's such a long season. You know, I don't know how many games, 135 games left or whatever it is. So we've battled some sickness throughout the first month and some injuries, so I think once everybody gets healthy and we start playing together, and it'll fall into place.
Final thing, how would you define your approach at the plate? Like, what's your mindset, and what are you trying to do each time you go up there to create a situation where you can have success?
I keep it simple. I just go up there and try to hit it hard. I don't really care where it goes or how far it goes. I just want to hit it hard.
There you have it. Pretty simple right there. Just wants to hit it hard, and he's done that consistently through the course of the year. Beautiful swing, great approach and mindset for Andrew Benintendi. And then another individual who's been great for the Red Sox so far on the batting average side is Xander Bogaerts. He is hitting for a 340 clip so far this year. Hasn't driven in a lot of runs, but has consistently hit well for the Red Sox this season. An opportunity to sit down with Xander Bogaerts in the Red Sox dugout prior to the team heading out on the road.
Joined by Xander Bogaerts, just kind of sum up the beginning of the season for you guys. Like, up and down the lineup, the averages are good. Collectively, it seems like you guys are having good at-bats, but runs have been difficult to come by other than, you know, a couple innings here and there. Why do you think that is?
I mean, it's the beginning of the season. Especially being in Boston, it's not that easy to hit in April. Everyone knows that. But, I mean, we've been playing good baseball. We have a winning record, as I can see. Pitchers were doing a great job. It's just up to us to keep doing it day after day and scoring some runs for them.
It seems like, you know, this is just kind of part of the process where sooner or later you look at the guys who are in this lineup, the guys in the rotation, the defense this team puts out there, the intangibles of the game, and you expect to see the Red Sox, regardless of what's going on right now, at the end of the season with, you know, one of the best records in baseball. Is that kind of how you guys are looking at it?
Yeah, I think we're all positive. We're looking at stuff positive, optimistic. We're playing good baseball. We had some tough losses, games that we were right in there. A few mistakes here and there messed up the game, but that's part of the game. You know, you're not going to win all. Control your bats, try to catch all the plays, make all the plays, and hopefully win games.
You know, I think a lot of fans forget the fact they're 24 years old because it seems like you've been around here forever. Yeah. And you've seen everything there is to see, you know, in Boston, from the greatest successes to, you know, difficult times. How have you evolved as a player from that beginning in 2013, you know, to now? What is the Xander Bogaerts of 2017? You know, what would he tell the guy in 2013?
A lot of adjustments. The big leagues are about a lot of adjustments. A lot of confidence you got to have. Even if you're struggling, you got to have confidence. Just try not to lose that. That's the main key. And adjustments. Pitcher's going to adjust to you. Defensively, you got to make adjustments. Know where to be. every time, not just one inning and next inning you take off. You know, you're not worried about defense. You got to be focused. A lot of people watching, a lot of people depending on you every day, and you got to be locked in.
Are you more proud of the adjustments that you've made, you know, offensively in terms of driving the ball more consistently, hitting for, you know, an incredibly high average, or what you've been able to do defensively and improving, you know, your range, going back on balls to both your sides and in on baseballs? Because that seems to be, you know, the area where you've put in, you know, perhaps, you know, the most work.
I'll probably say defense. I mean, I'm very proud of where I am today. I mean, every match would have been like this, but I'm very blessed, and I'm thankful for all the coaches that helped me, all the position players, shortstops that helped me out through the way. Petey also playing second base. I mean, they helped me a lot. You know, they wanted me to become a good player.
In terms of the mental side of the game, what are the most challenging aspects of handling, you know, that side of things? You mentioned, you know, the highs and the lows and the adjustments that take place. Obviously, balancing when to make an adjustment and when not to make an adjustment is a difficult call. I mean, if you're having success doing something, obviously you keep doing it. But if you're not having success, but you have in the past, then you're like, okay, do I change things or do I stay with, you know, what's brought
trust
me success
it, trust
and trust
it,
the
yeah.
process?
That's why you just got to go ahead and trust it. Sometimes you could change stuff, you could tweak stuff, but trust me, that'll only take place for a few days, and then you go back to the normal ways that you was, the normal way that you hit, or the way you stand up in the batter's box. That's how you're going to go back to. Just trust it, man. Trust it. Trust your coaches. Know that everyone is have confidence in you.
In 2013, did you expect after the World Series that year that this was how it was going to be, you know, each year, where it was just going to be, you know, a successive number of highs? You followed Derek Jeter. It's obviously your favorite player growing up. In 96, you know, it seemed like every year for him over a period of 5 or 6 years, he was in the World Series. Did you see things as that being your trajectory and there were more downtimes than expected?
I mean, that happened so fast. That happened so fast. 2013 happened so fast. So I definitely didn't think about being in the World Series every year, but probably being in a playoff race every year is what I would say. I mean, all the other teams in the big leagues are pretty good, so it's not you're going to get a free pass to the World Series. You got to work your way as a team, and I mean, we're looking good this year, you know, while we're playing some good games, and hopefully that continues so we can be there again.
Chris Sale's dominance right now is flat out amazing, and you know, I'm wondering what you're seeing from the shortstop perspective, and also how are you seeing him interjecting himself as a leader on this team as well? Do you see that taking place where obviously there's a void, you've mentioned it, with David Ortiz not being here anymore, and there's a lot of different people who can step up in a lot of different areas to fill that leadership gap. Do you see Sale doing that?
I mean, pretty much now he's being a stopper every time we go out. He's putting up some low numbers for the opposing teams, giving us a chance, a huge chance to be in a ball game. Some games we haven't scored runs for him, but every game he's been giving us a chance to win the game 100%. So he's been doing extremely well, and that's the type of pitcher that he is.
Final thing, you mentioned the fact that the team was missing, you know, David Ortiz in a lot of different ways. Do you expect as the weather gets warmer and as everybody starts to, you know, meet their potential and their ceiling, that is going to kind of go away, or do you think his shadow is going to be lingering for a while just because of the legend that he was?
He was a huge legend here, you know. He was a legend in baseball in general, but we got to do it without him. He's not going to come back. We got to collectively do it together, try to get on base, score runs, do the small things, move the guys over. If you can even bunt some balls, you know, doesn't matter if we win 13-2 or 2-1, a win is a win in the end.
Bogey, thanks a lot.
You got it.
All right, that is Red Sox shortstop Xander Bogaerts. Daron Harmon, safety for the Super Bowl champion New England Patriots, came to New Hampshire last week for an event at Pinkerton Academy in conjunction with United Way to talk about character and to talk about what it means to be an individual of character. And I thought it was a really interesting event. He was joined by teammate Matthew Slater and a couple of the Patriots cheerleaders and talking to middle school age students, you know, about what it takes to make good decisions in their lives. And I was really impressed with what Harmon had to say. We talked afterwards about character and the Patriots as they get ready for the 2017 season.
Joined by Daron Harmon, safety for the defending Super Bowl champion New England Patriots, as he came to Derry to speak to students on behalf of the United Way. And I thought, you know, the message about character is so important today with everything that's going on in our society. And how much does it mean to you to come out and, you know, talk to students about what's going on with character and how they can, you know, be individuals of character?
It's amazing. And to be honest, it's a blessing. I mean, to be able to be to use football as my platform to reach out to the youth, because, I mean, we look at it, they are the face of tomorrow. These are going to be the people who eventually run America, and you want to have positive impacts on the youth. And I think just being able to share some insight of my life, of how I try to live my life with great character, and how, you know, you'll still make mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. Nobody's perfect. But the faster that you can identify when you make a mistake and try to fix it and be genuine is what makes great people great people.
And I think it's so important, you know, for athletes, because athletes are, whether for good or for bad, are looked upon, you know, with greater interest than, you know, the fireman or the policeman or the individual who serves in the military. And a lot of your stories are relatable. Yours is a story of adversity, as is the case of many different athletes coming from Delaware, not having the same type of a football programs you'd find in a, you know, a larger area. And you had to overcome, you know, that adversity in order to make it. And the message of, you know, having that kind of singular focus that you pressed forth, whether it's in any field, is one that I think is important. Having your dream and then, you know, kind of keeping that vision and tunnel vision towards the dreams. So talk a little more in depth about, you know, that and how you, you know, how you focused on, you know, that dream of being an NFL football player and how it drove you.
I would say the first thing was I had a great mother, a mother who stuck by me through thick and thin, a mother who told me that I can do anything in this world. And I would just encourage parents to do the same. No dream is too big, and my mother let me know that from the beginning. And it's been times where people have told me that I wasn't going to be able to get to the NFL. I mean, like I said earlier, family members, I mean, they didn't know any better because they never seen it before. But I never let that discourage me. I continue to just, like my mom said, just stay focused on your dream. I mean, if you stay focused on your dream and you put everything in it, it's bound to happen. And that's what I did. I wanted something, and I was willing to sacrifice everything for it. I mean, I wasn't partying all the time. I wasn't not doing my schoolwork. I did everything I could so that I can be in a position to get there. So I knew that I had to get good grades in schools to get the scholarship, to get the schools to like me. I knew I had to work hard. I had to work harder than everybody else from Delaware because everybody was already so much far ahead of me with football being the way it is in Delaware. It's just when I got to college, I had to work hard because, I mean, Rutgers was a program on the up and coming, but it wasn't Alabama. It wasn't USC. So just continue to just have that vision ingrained, and all the decisions that I made had to reflect back to going back to the NFL. And I think if you always have your dream stuck in your brain, and when you make decisions, if you look back and you just realize, how would this affect me getting there? If it's good, all right, I'll do it. But if it's bad, maybe I need to stay away from it.
And there's a balance that's struck between having the support system, as you mentioned, with your mother, and also being motivated by the haters. Because no matter who the athlete is or who the person is, there's going to be people going to say, you know, you can't do this. And I think those people are just as important. Like, I remember, you know, a couple people telling me, you're never going to be able to make a living talking about sports. Like, that's just not going to happen. Like, it doesn't happen. And I remember that as much as I remember the people, or probably more so, the people who said, you know, you are going to this. It's important to strike that balance. And how do you use, you know, people who doubt you as motivation?
I mean, you don't want to use it too much, but at the same time, it drives you.
Right.
Just to kind of be like, I told you so, you know, because we're in a world where a lot of people, they are haters because they don't know any better. I mean, your vision is your vision. God didn't give you your vision for other people to see it. And I think when you get in that balance of, you know, people saying you can't do it, I mean, it drives you. And it's not really driving you to, technically, you just prove them wrong to say, but it's just letting you know that this person is going to be so surprised and so confused when it does happen. Right. But at the same time, when you do that, you'll hopefully change their mindset to be like, okay, well, he did that, so maybe what I want to do, maybe my dream isn't too big, and maybe I should fight for what I really want too.
Two more things. How many times have you watched the Super Bowl since the game? A, and what's it been like, you know, this off season, you know, after, you know, that game and the afterglow of it?
I watched it a few times. I'd probably say I watched it probably like five times. I watched it more so the week after. That's when I kind of like watched it. Like,
do you watch the whole thing or do you
watch the whole thing? Because it's like a movie.
Right.
It's literally like a movie. You know, the team goes in there, plays bad at first, and halftime comes, and then just everything turns around, and it's just this great comeback story. And you just see just literally all the sacrifice and how hard everybody played in that second half to get the goal of winning the championship. And it just gives you such more appreciation than like when you're playing in it, because you're not thinking about it. You're just thinking, all right, we got to do this to get back, get the ball back to Tom. But like when you watch it, you see the effort and the amount of plays, the intensity that we played with at that time. I mean, it's beautiful. I mean, it's encouraging, and I'm definitely appreciative to be able to be on that team and still on that team today.
It's amazing, you know, you go around New England now and 28-3 comes up and everybody knows exactly what it means. In the Boston Marathon, there's a guy holding up a sign that said 28-3 on Heartbreak Hill to get the people across the finish line, and it's so awesome. Patriots secondary has always been one of the strengths of the team, you know, since you've been there. Mm-hmm. Do you see you guys being even better this year with the addition of Stephen Gilmore? Obviously, Logan Ryan was a big part of things, but you know, Gilmore is one of the best in the league.
I tell you this, man. It's always tough, man, because you can't win games like right now. So it's going to take a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of studying, a lot of hard working to get to where we were last year. I mean, that group was together, mm-hmm. think about it, for 2+ years. Mm-hmm. So, and we just got to continue to just try to just find that cohesiveness that we had last year. I mean, it's going to be a process. Even if Logue was here, I mean, each year is its own year. So we're going to have to start all over again. We're going to have to go out there. We're going to have to put the work in. And we got to just continue to just try to play the best that we can to try to be the best secondary that we can for our team to go out there and be successful.
Duron, thanks a lot. Thanks for coming to New Hampshire. We'll catch up with you soon.
All right, sounds good.
All right, also caught up with Connor Green, top pitching prospect of the Blue Jays organization. He's with the Fisher Cats right now. He got his first win of the season on Saturday in a game at down in Manchester where he topped out at 102 miles an hour.
So for you this season, kind of talk about what some of the overall goals are as you look to continue to build and work your way through the organization.
It is consistency. It is just being consistent every fifth day. Good game or bad, I don't change who I am or my plan of attack. And it doesn't matter, you know, really even who's hitting. I have the same approach and hopefully it pays off, and it seems to have, so I'm very happy with it.
Yeah, it's one of the things that Bobby Meacham talked about last year is that, you know, you have all the entire skill set, but he wanted to see, you know, kind of that mentality of not caring about the batter and having, you know, more of that, you know, Pedro Martinez bulldog type approach of, you know, an arrogance, if you will, where when you take the mound and you're the best and you're just going to kind of go after guys. Has that been something that's changed for you this year? You're still kind of, you know, trying to find that niche in terms of having that commanding, you know, number one type personality.
Yeah, I mean, you always got to be confident and internally just believe that you can get it done. So, yeah, and I do believe that. And, you know, it goes the same for everybody on the field. And we all believe in each other, too. So that, you know, that helps. And it goes a long way. It goes way further than you'd imagine, you know, the energy in the clubhouse, energy on the field. So, yeah, I completely believe that if I throw a low fastball or throw my, you know, my best changeup or my best curveball, it's not going to get touched very well. So, absolutely, you know, you go after guys with no fear, and you know, you hope, you know, you don't hope, you believe that you're going to come out on top. You know you will.
One of the most difficult parts of being a minor league baseball player, in my view, is, you know, kind of generating your own emotion and excitement for the game. And obviously it's easier for a starting pitcher, you know, to focus for that one outing. But, you know, the first outing, we're out watching you, and there was probably, I counted, it was probably about 100 people here. And it was cold, and it was freezing, and that's the way that baseball is in the minor leagues early on the season. The crowds are small. The games mean so much to you, but how do you go about, you know, kind of focusing in an environment where it's every baseball player dreams of, you know, the 40,000 or in the Blue Jays case, 50,000 people at Rogers Center cheering every pitch. But, you know, this is a lot different in terms of generating your own excitement.
I've gotten a lot better at that. Earlier in my career, it was tough, but now actually I've seen Rogers Center, the building itself, and I just imagine, you know, this is my show right now. So if it's not the big leagues, right, but, you know, I'm treating this New Hampshire Stadium like it is it's the big league, it's the big time, it's the show, and I try and make every pitch as intense and as adrenaline-filled as if I was in the big time, because when I get there, I want to feel like I've already been there and that I've already repeated my delivery and I've already executed my pitches at that level.
That's New Hampshire Fisher Cat Connor Green. This is The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. Welcome back here on The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. I am Chris Ryan. This segment of the show presented by the Prescription Center, where the health of you and your family comes first. Matt is in Texas. I am here in the great state of New Hampshire. And I wanted to go back a little bit here to the basketball playoffs, as the Celtics are tied at two games apiece with the Washington Wizards. And there's been a clamoring for change with the Celtics. People want to see a different starting lineup. They want to see a different rotation. They want to see something new going into game number five. So I've said that, you know, if you're going to make a change, they should probably address the deficiencies, and that's on, you know, the half-court defense and defensive rebounding. And, you know, the change that most people, the fans have wanted, and talk show hosts and et cetera, they want Jaylen Brown in the starting lineup. And I don't know how that helps the Celtics deal with, you know, what their problems are, in my view. And that's, you know, on the defensive side of things, defensive rebounding and half-court defense. As I've said, I think I would put Jonas Jerebko in, and that would be the change I would make instead of Amir Johnson.
The four.
So they want to take some fans want to take out Jay Crowder, and because he hasn't had the greatest postseason in the world, and slot in Jaylen Brown there, and then do whatever at the four. But I don't think you need or should take Jay Crowder out of the starting lineup and put Jaylen Brown in. I would say Amir Johnson gets dropped from the rotation, and you put Jonas Jerebko in.
I'm not going to pretend to know the right answer, but if you've lost two in a row the way the Celtics have lost, then that's like a, you know, that's a key decision. Do I need to shake things up? Do I need to make a change that's going to change or affect the dynamics of the game, of matchup, style of play, you know, really shake things up? Or do I say, look, we have a better team. If we play the way we're supposed to play and execute the way we're supposed to execute, then we will win. We still have home court advantage, and stick with it that way. Because, you know, you make a big change, it could also backfire. Of course, you know, not making a change and having it backfire, to me at this point, has a small downside because they've gotten blown out the last two games. But, you know, it's something every coach has to figure out once, and that's another reason why I like the Spurs position better, because once you lose multiple games in a row in a playoff series, you got to start thinking about, do I need to tweak something? Do I need to make a change? Do I need to shake things up? So we'll see what he does.
Yeah, I think that the playoffs, you know, give a great kind of spotlight for, and certainly, you know, general managers and coaches have a feel for the roster and who's going to perform and who's not going to perform, what the deficiencies are, better than any of the fans or media people do, because they're there on a day in, day out basis. And I think that should be said first and foremost. But I think that, you know, we talked a lot about the depth the Celtics have this year, and they certainly have a lot of good players and really good players. But one of the things that we've noticed is that a lot of times the postseason, if you're optimally building a roster like the Warriors, the Heat used to get to do, and you know, the Cavs do, is you want to have you know, guys who come off the bench who are like Matt Bonner and do, you know, one or two things really, really well. And the Celtics don't necessarily have that with their bench. We're seeing that here in this series, where, you know, the series is demanding a guy who can be a really good help defender and a guy who can rebound. And, you know, that's not necessarily there. A guy who can shoot the three-pointer incredibly well. A lot of teams, you know, have that. It seems like the Celtics, that's missing. The role player who
specialist.
Can, the specialist. You can fill a spot when you need it. And if you're in a series where you need smalls, you know, you have the small who come in and will do what you need to do. And they have, you know, lockdown defenders, but it's Rozier, it's Smart, it's Avery Bradley, and that seems to be, you know, missing from the Celtics arsenal right now is that, you know, the specialists.
It's definitely an interesting point. You know, when you have someone like that who fills a specific role and is dependable in the other facets of the game, you know, you talked about shaking things up or forcing a team to change some aspect of their strategy or style of play. That's a way to do it. You know, we see it with the Rockets last night, and I'm sure we'll see it next game when Nene went down with the groin injury. They basically went to a 7-man rotation, and at certain points, they had Ryan Anderson playing the 5, and they'd move Ariza to the 4, and then, you know, James Harden, Eric Gordon, Lou Williams. I mean, how do you guard those 5 guys?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have 5 knockdown 3-point shooters, 1 through 5, and everybody's sharing the ball and attacking and kicking. It's, you know, I was watching it, and I'm thinking, man, like, what are you supposed to do? You just got to do your best to contest, get them off the line, and hope they miss. But you know, a lot of those guys are guys who can play multiple positions and who have that specific skill set of being able to shoot the heck out of the ball. And you can kind of shuffle around and play with lineups and really force the Spurs to react defensively in their strategy and how they guard things, and also in their lineups.
Yeah,
you know, do you play both bigs against that really small lineup and try to do your best on defense and then punish them in the paint on the other end, or does their style win out and then you have to adjust and go small to try to match up with them and slow them down? You know, these are tough decisions for coaches to make, and it can really shift the tide of a game in a series if you have those substitution capabilities based on your personnel.
Yeah, and in concluding, I mean, that's something the Rockets have, that's something that the Cavs have, that's something that the that the Warriors have. You know, and the Spurs.
Yeah, the Warriors would put Durant at the 5.
Right. And
you basically have like your 2-3 wing guy who's 7 feet tall. And if you want, you can put him at the 5. Good luck matching up with that lineup on the floor.
And that's, you know, a precursor to, you know, for the Spurs moving on to the next round is how do your best lineup is probably when you have Gasol and Aldridge at the floor, and Gasol's been kind of mixed in and out with the top units becoming off the bench. But can you afford to do that when, you know, as you mentioned, you have Ariza at the 4, Ryan Anderson at the 5 with Houston, and that leaves the ball in Coach Popovich's court, where Mike D'Antoni is doing a good job, if that group is scoring, of dictating, you know, how the play is going to go. And that's always been, you know, kind of what the Spurs have had to do, where you have the tools, but he has the toolbox, Coach Pop has, but it's figuring out which ones to use in which spot. And sometimes it goes great, and sometimes it doesn't, as we've seen over the course of these of many years, when you're with the team, obviously, now.
Every team needs that versatility in their lineup to match, to be able to either go small or go medium or go big and be successful and effective with any 3 of those situations. If you can't, it's going to be really hard to win a championship unless you can really impose your style of play. You know, whether it's with big guys like Memphis, you know, they like playing 2 bigs, old school, blue collar, physical team. Or if you're playing against a team that likes to go small and shoot 3s and run up and down like the Rockets, you need to be able to match up with both of those styles of play to win a championship. And, you know, it's important when GMs are putting together their roster that they think about that.
Yeah, and the Celtics are going to do what they're going to do with their roster. And even when you have smalls in there, the Celtics are still going to play, you know, the same way. They're going to set screens up top, try to get Isaiah free. Isaiah's going to drive and dish, and he's going to shoot a lot of 3s. So it doesn't really change even when they go small. And again, that's the lack of versatility that this current roster has. Matt, as always, appreciate joining us for the program.
All right, thanks for having me.
It's The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. That segment of the show presented by the Prescription Center.